Hi, and welcome to this week's Shortcuts with Owen McCabe. And today I'm talking to Richard Lang. And Richard is a gentleman who I met and had the pleasure of doing a workshop with a number of years ago at this stage. Richard is he's a teacher of spirituality, he's a psychotherapist, but he's also the man behind The Headless Way, which is a charity, an organization set up for promoting the work of Douglas Harding, not very different, a very different Douglas, Douglas Harding. And full details of all of this amazing work and fascinating information is on his website, headless.org. And more about that, we'll come back to that later. But Richard, thanks for joining me today and welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for inviting me in, and hello to all your listeners.
So, Richard, maybe if you want to give people a feel for what this is all about. I mean, I've mentioned the name Douglas Harding and The Headless Way. So do you want to sort of put all that into some sort of a context for people, and how you're connected to all this and what got you started with it?
Yes, okay. Well, Douglas Harding, who died, I don't know, 5-6 years ago or something, he asked the question, who am I? He was an English philosopher, and he observed something very simple about himself, which anyone can notice, which is that you cannot see your own head. Now, in his inquiry into the question, who am I, this came after quite a lot of thinking and noticing that what he was depended on the range of the observer. So from, say, where you're looking, of course, I've got a head. And if I asked, who am I, you'd say, well, you're Richard, you see. I can see your face on your shoulders. And Douglas took a step back and just looked at himself for himself, which your listener can do now. What am I from my own point of view? And when you look, at least when I look, I can see a bit of my nose and those sensations, and I can see my body. But above my chest, right now I'm looking, I see no head, no face. I'm looking out of a single eye, as it were, or no eyes. And instead of my head, I've got the world. So this is quite a different view from other people's view of me, and a wonderful view. I'm built open. I'm spacious for the world. Everything is in me. So basically, this is a non-verbal experience. I challenge anyone to say sincerely they can see their own head right now. Now, of course, you can see it in a mirror, but that's showing you what you look like at a range of a few feet, I suppose. And if you held the mirror further away, you'd see your whole body. That's what you look like there. And the question is, this is a kind of modern science-inspired view of oneself. What am I? The question is, what are you now in your own experience? Put aside what others tell you for the moment. They're not right where you are. And look for yourself. And so I say, well, from my point of view, I am looking out of a single eye or space, which kind of the view out fades towards the edges into nothingness. Because it's a nonverbal experience, describe it as you like. When I turn around, for others, I turn and the room is still. For me, I'm still and the room moves. Or when I'm with another person, from my point of view, it's not face-to-face, it's face-to-no-face. I have your face instead of my own. I'm built open for you. So in lots of ways, this simple observation of what it's like to be oneself turns everything upside down and inside out. So how's that for a start?
I'm kind of wondering where to go with that.
Blown your head away.
Yeah. Well, I think that pretty much wraps up the interview. So, Richard, it was great talking to you.
You see, you can actually share this in a minute flat. You know, yes, it's so simple and obvious. And when people say, "Okay, I can't see my face," well, so what? Okay, right. Well, you've got the experience. Let's find out if it has any practical use for you or any meaning for you. It does for me. So I can communicate what it means to me and so on, and you check out whether it touches you. You've got the experience, and if you Douglas developed a whole load of experiments, he called them, for testing this out, and they are visual and non-visual, and they apply to different aspects in one's life. And the simplest, probably, is just to point your finger back at where they see your face and have a look. You see, that's the place we're talking about. And I'm doing that right now, and I see my finger, I don't see my face. In words, I say I'm pointing at my no face, this boundless, open, aware space, so to speak, full of my finger, full of my thoughts and feelings, sensations. The squirrel outside the window I can see now, full of the whole world. And something you can notice right now, I hope you are doing, and then you can practice, as it were. You can go on noticing this and build this in to your life, consciously coming from your true self, as it may be described. It's up to you. Do the experiments, like we're just going to probably do a few more in this interview. You've got the experience. The challenge or the invitation is to live consciously from this. I mean, right now I've got a phone, and I know that if you came in the room, you'd see me talking on the phone with my phone next to my ear. For me, I can see a bit of a blurry hand and a bit of a phone, but the rest disappears into the great void here. And I'm hearing your voice, and I'm hearing my voice coming out of this one silence. And from my point of view, not only is the whole world within me, all voices are within me. So it's very accessible and a marvelous thing to be with others and have their face and their voice as well as one's own voice. Would you agree with that?
I guess... You kind of have to, because what you're describing is your literal experience is in simple terms as possible. So it's almost childlike in terms of and it's not trying to you're minimizing the conceptual layers, as it were. You're deconstructing it. Maybe I'm not sure how to put it, but it's like this is nothing to do with intellect, really, is what I'm getting.
No, but of course you can use your intellect to think about it. But one way of thinking about it is that we have four main stages in our lives, and put very simply, the baby, the child, the adult, and the seer. The baby is headless; it's pre-verbal. Looks in the mirror, that's not its head, it's just wide open. And people love being around babies because this basic openness is so infectious. So you're headless, you're at large, a space for the world, but you don't think of it in those terms or any terms. As you grow up, people reflect back what you look like from their point of view through language and body language. And childhood is getting the idea that you are something, that people can see you, that you're a thing, a person. You learn your name, your age, your gender, and you learn how to speak and reflect that back to others. So childhood is a sort of intermediate stage where you're getting the idea of being a person, being in a body, being the one in the mirror, taking that image and putting it on. But you haven't quite fully got into the box, so that's why it's also very nice to be around children, because they kind of give you permission to access that openness and playfulness yourself. Growing up, as an adult, we now fully identify with the one in the mirror, with what others see. And the idea of being space or headless, we relegate to childish nonsense or something, madness even. Of course you're not. I'm not space for the world. I'm a thing. I'm what you tell me I am.
Yeah.
Now, most of us think, that's what life is about. Life's about growing up, is about finding out who you are and then making the best of it, really. Well, there's another stage which we call, that's the baby, the child, the adult. The fourth stage is the seer, or call it what you like, where you reawaken to your original headless openness, but now you don't forget who you are in the world, so you've got both. So I'm aware of being Richard. I'm profoundly identified with being Richard. But I call that, if you like, my public identity. My private identity, which only I can see, is this headless openness, which I've always been, but which now I've got language to communicate about with you. And we're communicating about being both people and being a headless one. Would you say?
So, yeah, I I'm intrigued. Like, I know your breakthrough with this was when you attended a workshop given by Douglas Harding back, I think, in 1970. Can you talk me through that? And in terms of what your experience was like before the workshop, in other words, your experience of day-to-day life before the workshop and then since the workshop.
Well, I was very young, I suppose, at 17 when I met Douglas, and I had, in my early teens, I was a Christian, and I was interested in the deep things in Christianity, union with God, rather unusual probably for a teenager at that year, but that's not that unusual. But anyway, I was interested in mystical experience. And I remember when I was about 14, I'd been to some kind of sermon in the local town. I came back just completely open, and I didn't put words on it like I would now, but I would now say I was had a headless experience. I remember the sky and everything being at large being hit within me. And my friend said, it'll pass, Richard, and it did. Yeah. And I didn't know how to get back to it. It was a very strong experience. I remember it now. And then I sort of moved away from Christianity because it didn't really give me that. And this was the late 60s, and started reading about other religions. And one of them, of course, was Buddhism, which was just sort of, you know, hadn't been around in England for that long. And I read a book, found out about a Buddhist conference, and went with my brother, David, in 1970. And there we met Douglas, who did a workshop, and he was sort of in the Buddhist social scene, or no, not social scene, but the Buddhist Society had printed a book of his on having no head, and he was there. He wasn't particularly a Buddhist, but he was relating the headless experience to Buddhism. So I did the workshop, pointed a finger, and got the point. And, you know, of course, someone else might point a finger and still see that, notice you can't see your face, but it means little or nothing to them. For some reason, I guess my background, it meant an awful lot to me, or it meant something. And what happened was I went back to school, and it meant something for my brother as well. It touched us. And we did the experiments in the workshop, you know. And then went to see him a few months later because I got doubts, and went with my brother and my mother, actually, who'd wondered what, you know, had happened to us because it touched us. So we were, you know, 17, went to his house, stayed the weekend, lots of people there, as there usually was, people interested in seeing, and sort of, you know, asked questions and cleared up quite a number of my puzzles about it, how it made sense. Because I think when you have this experience, in some way you've got to make some sense of it, relate it to your ordinary experience. How does it fit in with the experience of having a head, you know, of being a thing? And that was the great work Douglas did, particularly in his book The Hierarchy of Heaven and Earth, but it's in all the other books on having a head, making sense of this basic experience and how it fits in with one's the social view of oneself and how you act and behave, you know, in ordinary life. And I think just me personally at that, you know, I very quickly thought, wow, this is amazing. This is so different from anything else I'm reading about, these experiments, this very kind of experientially based approach. It's basically experience. It's not an argument, a debate. Point and look. Can you see your face now? Can you see your eyes? You've got sensations there. Do they have color and shape from your point of view? Look in the mirror. Where's your, you know, it's very direct experience, and it's appealing to you as the authority on you, not to someone else. So for all these reasons, it was very attractive. It was really saying, you're the authority on you. No one else is there. Look for yourself. Take seriously what you find and live from that. And here are some indications of how it might affect your life with your relationships or terms of creativity or in your health, in lots of ways. And so I kind of thought, right, I'm going to spend my life sharing this, I think. You know, this is brilliant. So I went to university. Already at university, I started running workshops in my room.
Wow.
Yes, and used to visit Douglas almost every other weekend and get to know, you know, people went, didn't charge anything, it was just sharing seeing. So there's a whole group of friends who were sharing seeing, and so it was non-hierarchical, because once you, when you see your no-head, you can't see it more clearly or less clearly than anyone else. So at that level, there's no hierarchy. And so I really, from that point on, I was part of a social circle around Douglas where everyone was aware of their headless true nature and sharing it in their own unique way. And so I kind of grew up in a mini society of headless friends.
Nice.
And it's very infectious when you're around others who are consciously being headless. It's like being around a baby. You're affected, you know, it gives you permission to drop your face, or a child, it gives you permission to drop your adult kind of self and be a child. When you're with other adults, and we're all adults, then we sort of infect each other with that, I'm in a box, you're in a box. But when then you awaken again to your original nature, now you've got both, because, you know, you and I are kind of reflecting back our human identities and sharing our different views. But at the same time, this is happening in one open space or one silence. Your voice, my voice, thoughts and feelings are going on in this one unchanging spaciousness. And this is sort of infectious. And the more I go on, the more I enjoy, in terms of sharing, making friends that are enjoying this. And you know, one doesn't go around making students or disciples, one goes around making friends.
And would you say, Richard, that this is a state that you're pretty much in 24/7, the open state?
I think that when you see this, you realize it's a kind of paradoxical thing. Because when you're seeing it now, it's not really seeing it in time. You look out, and I don't know, you know, whatever time it is there, 10 past 11 or whatever, that's the time there. But when you point back, there's no time here. So each time you look, you're kind of returning to a timeless place. But at the level of, you know, kind of getting into the habit of being aware of this, of bringing your attention back here, so to speak, I think that if you want to do it, it grows in you. You know, you just want to, I want to go there. Right. So, you know, it's not really a job. It's more, or a task. It's more like, you know, like holiday in a way. You want to go there. And the more that you return your attention here, the more it grows on you. And after a little while, you realize, you know, when I don't attend to it, it doesn't go away.
It's always there. Yes.
Yeah. So the anxiety about how much you're doing it kind of fades away, but you kind of do it more. So if it's not on the front burner, it's on the back burner. And to bring it to the front burner, you can do it in the wink of an eye. You know, look now, there it is. Did it go away? No. Has it deteriorated? No. And I think, in a way, that this, the level where you feel that you go away from it and come back is a natural rhythm, which kind of, you know, it's like if you don't see a good friend for a while and you see them again, it's a joy, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. So when you fall back into that space of silence, is it characterized by the absence of thinking? In other words, the thinking?
No.
It's not? Okay.
No, thoughts. I'm thinking now, just as I'm speaking, and my thoughts and feelings and my voice and sensations and everything are occurring in this space.
Okay.
And thinking does not get in the way of being aware of this silence, as you call it. The thoughts are coming out of this silence.
Okay. So yeah. you just don't identify with them. So in other words, you witness them like you'd witness anything, like the weather, like someone like water flowing through a river. It's not something that you get caught up in as
no. You see, I think then we're into language and we describe it in different ways. And, you know, I get caught up in my thoughts and feelings like anyone else. But at the same time, I now have, I am aware that I can observe this from this space that is not caught up in anything. And anyone can. And this does not mean that then the problem immediately dissolves. You now observe whatever problem you've got from this problem-free space, which is where you're really looking at it from anyway. So you're just being honest and truthful and so on. And as you observe it, then the problem will change and develop, but it doesn't mean that when you see this space, suddenly all problems or tension goes away. I mean, we can just do a little experiment here. If you and the listener hold out your hand, you see your hand and you don't see your face. And so I, in language, would say that I am space for my hand. I am capacity for the color and the shape and the movement there. And now if I become aware of the sensation of my hand, in the same way I could say, well, I'm capacity for the sensation of the hand as well. Now, if I make my hand into a fist, it's tense. The stress there, if you like. Now, does that stress affect the space? It doesn't for me. The space doesn't get stressed. It's stress there to no stress here. Now, if I open my hand, it feels relaxed. Does the space get relaxed? Well, no. There's nothing here to either stress or relax. So now I have just got the experience there that I can observe stress from this stress-free zone. That makes a huge difference.
Yes.
To be aware of this stress-free place, this thought-free place while you're thinking. It's fantastic. You've got to try this out. But, I mean, either you notice it or you overlook it.
it's a space that's untouchable, really, isn't it? And you're right in terms of needing to just try it for yourself. And the book, your book, Seeing Who You Really Are, I remember when I read it, doing a lot of the experiments, because the experiments you talk about, they're listed in some detail in that book.
Yeah.
And they're very simple. And they're some of them are almost like what you see children play. It's so beautifully simple. But it is very easy for people to overlook this because we take so much for granted and we assume we know stuff and we don't question things that are literally staring us in the face.
I know. What we're doing now is questioning it, aren't we? You know, you got one life. Have a go. Wake up. Don't just, do what everyone else tells you to do or think whatever, look for yourself. And it is like being a child. I mean, surprise, surprise. It's what we've always been, is this open space. And childhood is the kind of, if you like, moving away from it into your body or self, forgetting it. The thing about childhood is the job you've got there, so to speak, is put your head on and get in your body and act as if you're I'm Richard or whoever you are. But we've all done that as adults. And now the job, if you want, the pleasure, the invitation, is to reawaken to this original point of view. And it is easy to forget, but it's easy to remember. And it's even easier, I would say, to remember if you've got friends who are doing it too, because it's infectious, like the baby's openness is infectious. So, we're seeing now, you and myself, and that hopefully is infecting the listener, and anyone who listens to this can join us in being aware of this timeless silence or space in which this conversation is happening and in which their own thoughts are happening. It's mysterious and wonderful and wild and very different from our normal take on things. It doesn't negate our normal take on things. That's the public view. Me on the phone in England to you on the phone in Ireland. you know. But the inside view is there's one awareness here in which all this, my voice, your voice, the listener's thoughts, and so on, and sensations are happening. So, gosh, I mean, to refuse this, you know, why say no to something so glorious, really?
Absolutely, and liberating, I would say, as well.
So liberating, isn't it? I mean, you're not confined in anything. Everything is in you.
Yeah.
And yet you kind of, you know, go along and people just see you as this person walking down the street, and you know who you're seeing who you really are. You're at large. You're huge. Everything is in you. What, you know. And when you see who you are and you go on seeing who you are, people say, well, you know, I mean, do you ever get used to it, Richard? You say, no. You know, like, how can you get used to this? I mean, if you're not actually lying on the floor in shock, I think there's something wrong with you. I am standing up at the moment, but, you know, the more that you keep communication about it, like you and I now, is bringing it onto the front burner.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why it's so lovely to meet with friends, because with it comes wonder and astonishment and, you know, shock in a way. And a kind of, you know, humility in a way before the fact of who one is. It's astonishing, really.
I presume you're traveling a lot, giving workshops and helping people to see, pointing out the obvious to them. Talk to me a bit about what, because, you know, the show on trust, the headless way, you've taken it on to get, spread this message about as much as possible.
Yeah.
So, you know, how far do you go? Where do you go? And how often?
Oh, well, it changes all the time. I have traveled a lot, you know, to different parts of the world. I love it. I sort of go where I'm asked, or, you know, where it feels appropriate. So it's changing, you know, over the years. It changes where I go, and other friends are sharing it too. We also have regular free Skype meetings, 4 a week at the moment, because obviously we can't all meet if we're around the planet. But through modern technology, Skype, for example, we can all meet together and share, and love doing it. It's infectious. But, yes, just going wherever one is asked and making friends, hopefully.
And have you seen a growth in interest in over the last 5-6 years?
Yes, if you go right back, you know, to the beginning with Douglas on his own, he woke up to this. I mean, you know, it didn't just kind of come out of the blue. He was working on this for 10 years before it kind of, the headless bit came to him. There's a whole story around that. But he was then on his own, basically, for 20 years with this experience.
Wow.
And failed during that time, if you like, to actually meet someone else who really got what he was talking about, and they shared it like we are doing now. And then he shared it. And the first real sharing was in 1964. And it blew his mind, you can imagine. And he thought to himself, I can die now. I've shared it with one other person. I think, you know, it's just so brilliant and important in a way to share it. And the one, if you like, this one consciousness is divided into many, partly, I would say, to have the joy of sharing it, to, you know, talk about itself in a way. Lots of other reasons, I'm sure. But then that was 64. And then after that, gradually a few more people said yes. He developed the experiment. And by the time I met him in 1970, there were lots of people. Well, compared to now, there weren't that many. But it was growing. And I think Douglas learned as he went along, and learned that just in a way, assume people have got it. Don't make it difficult. Don't say this is a hard thing. Say this is the easiest thing, because it is. And you can't see your head, right? I mean, could you get anything easier to observe than that? I don't think so. And with the development of the experiment and with more contact, then people tell people, people share it, it's infectious, it grows, it kind of grows of its own in a way, with a little help from whoever wants to help, you know. And so then with the internet, of course, with seeing being so visual in many ways, the experiments being so physical and visual, it's very easy to illustrate. And it's very much in the spirit of modern times. Be your own authority. Look for yourself. Don't rely on others. There's no hierarchy at this level. This is basically free. You've got it. You don't need us, but come back if you want to be a friend. All this kind of thing is very attractive and makes it easy to share. And so over the last 10 years, it's continued to grow. And I think there are, I know people get in touch and say, I went to your website, I did the pointing experiment, I've got what you're talking about. Amazing. I spent 10 years reading books on this or doing this and that, but you've just showed me, you know, in a moment. Thank you. And I think that happens a lot. And people love it, you know, they love it. It's free. Basically.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I think that's
and it's
it.
Real. It's not just an idea, it's real. You get the experience.
It's interesting that more and more people are getting it and getting it quite quickly. So
yes.
And it doesn't seem to be dependent on our culture. Language and culture don't seem to be a barrier in any way.
No.
Yeah.
And our experiments and films, got lots of films on YouTube channel.
Yeah.
Friends translate them into other languages. Including Russian, Japanese, you know, Greek, French, German, whatever. And it makes no difference what culture you come from at all, really, I think. I think those that say yes to it, it's a very deep thing. I don't really understand why some say yes and some say no. I mean, everyone has the experience, but whether they sort of invite it into their lives is another thing. That's up to them, of course. But yes, it's a simple thing to share, and it grows and grows. Yeah, it's delightful.
I'll share. When I did the workshop, I found the exercises fascinating, and for a time afterwards, I was aware of something, you know. Now I didn't get the full blown sort of collapse into self and all the layers sort of falling away and a deep sense of oneness. I was looking for that. And yet I completely get what you're pointing to in terms of the eye, that really all there is this big eye. It's like a big cinema screen. And that's it.
That's it. And if we think that enlightenment or whatever big name we're going to give it is going to involve a collapse of the ego and a continual state of wow or peace or bliss, well, that's not what the Headless Way is on about. The Headless Way is on about direct perception of who you really are and then take what you get. And it is not. I mean, I don't really know what a total collapse of the ego forever and ever would be like. I think you'd end up in a hospital. You know, I don't know how you'd function. Well, I don't understand what it means, but that may be my limitation. Because I love having an ego. Mm-hmm. I love being a person. Mm-hmm. And I love others, you know. This sense of oneself as a separate self does not get in the way of seeing your single eye. I'm feeling I'm here and you're there. At the same time, I'm aware of one consciousness in which this is happening. And so I think it's a bit confusing and misdirected in a way if this experience is presented next to the kind of idea that your ego will dissolve, you'll never have problems, you'll be in bliss, you'll never now leave awareness of who you are. all this, you know. To me, it's not like that, and I'm quite glad it's not like that.
So, Richard, would you allow your life to sort of flow from that space on a day-to-day basis, or would you be someone who still, well, not still, because I don't know if you did in the past, but would you be one for setting goals and planning and structure? And?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Both. Yeah. I think it's not either or.
Okay.
You see, I think that when you're a baby, you don't have language, and you're pre-verbal, so we're, you know, putting words into a babe's mouth, as it were. But you don't plan. You don't have a sense of control. You're wide open, so you could say everything's just flowing. Growing up is identifying with your appearance and learning to make choices and make plans and, you know, take care of yourself and those around you and so on. And you, in a way, you kind of move away from that choiceless awareness, if you like. When you're now reawakened to your true nature, you've got both. You've got this awareness of this choiceless awareness, which everything just moves through, and you're not in control, and so on. And at the same time, you're aware of making choices and being active and being responsible to a degree and all that. And so both go together. And this kind of back and forth between who you really are and your human identity. And this is a wonderful thing. And of course, life, you know, you now want to draw on the source that you've reawoken to, and you want to surrender to it, and you want to, you know, but part of that is thinking up what the plan for what you want to do next, perhaps, you know. So it's there isn't a simple answer, I think. It's both and.
You said a word there which resonated for me, surrender, and I would think that that's quite important to live in a way that surrenders to the deeper, to the true self, to oneness, to consciousness, whatever word people want to use, and it's almost to allow one to be, to some degree, guided by that, or, you know, whether it's true intuition or following your heart, whatever phrase people put on it, but it's I guess, you know, that whole idea of surrendering to the bigger picture, I think is
a very deep thing, this. But I was once in a workshop. I spent a lot of time with Douglas. We're friends. I used to travel with him a lot and go to workshops he did and help him, you know, with his friends, and kind of learn a lot through that and meet a lot of people. And we were probably in the 80s, we were in Paris doing a workshop, and the subject of surrender came up. And I was sitting next to Douglas, and we were facing the audience, as it were, you know, rows of chairs. And it got into a discussion, you know, in the audience about abandonment and surrender. And Douglas leaned over to me and he said, "Seeing your no face is absolute surrender." And what he meant was that when you look here, nothing remains. You know, you don't just lose your face. You lose your back. You lose a background. You lose your mind. Your mind is there coming out of here. But you lose everything. This is perhaps why people resist this.
Yes.
Because it's real disappearance, total, at a glance. It's not something you work yourself up to.
Yeah.
Right? You know, it's whoop, whoa. It's not even a feeling. It's gone, 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 gone. And therefore, instantly reborn as everything. You can't, you know, you can't half get here and half be the world. So this is profound surrender through perception, not through working up a feeling or certain kinds of actions that are surrendered and others are not. Well, that's all true. But that's downstream of the source, if you like. And so if you point back at the void now, this is true, deep, profound, absolute surrender of everything, all color, all shape, all life, all mind, not here. Point out, and there it is. So then we don't have to worry too much about, you know, feeling surrendered or pay attention to this. You see, that you can do that right. We can't always surrender. I can't, you know, to things. but this is nothing, and it's always available. And that is so kind and true, actually. But test it, you know.
You mentioned the ego earlier, and I reckon the ego must be what stops people from saying yes to this, because it is about the. When you accept this, it's about realizing. Well, the ego is put in its place, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Yeah.
Yes. It's out there as part of your exchange with others in the world. Mm. And it is what we need. But if we imagine it here at one center, well, we've misplaced it. And that's the problem.
Yeah.
The problem isn't really, in my view, the ego. It's where you're locating it.
Exactly. Yeah.
And once you locate it where it is, somewhere there in the, you know, in your exchanges with others and in your thoughts and in the mirror, it's a valuable, important, understandably flawed, if you like, thing, you know, but it's not here. And that's the freedom. I've got an ego, but it's not here.
So it's a tool, really. The ego is a tool. It's to play with within this physical sort of space, really, isn't it? I mean, it's not to identify with and believe we're it.
I think you're right there. But I would put it slightly differently, which is why it's great to have friends, you know, different views. Because I would say that in growing up, part of what happens when you grow up, you see, when you're a baby, you're not very aware of yourself. Your ego is not very real, I suppose, you know. Growing up is really learning to take it seriously. I mean, you don't play as Richard. You know, I don't play as Richard. I will jump out of the way of the oncoming bus. I will defend myself if necessary. You know, it is a very real, deep thing. Now, when one wakes up to who you really are and see that the ego is not central, does this mean that then it is just a kind of play thing that one can, you know, do with or without and doesn't really matter? Not at all. For me, it is located. That's all true. It's a picture in consciousness. At the same time, it's profoundly real, and so are others. And so that's where when people say, yes, you see, life is an illusion, it's a game, I fully understand that. You know, that's true. But the other end of the spectrum or paradox is also true for me. It's profoundly real and beautiful and poignant, and we take it seriously. So, yeah.
So, the I suppose people who might be listening to this might be, and if they haven't come across the Headless Way before, they may be trying to make sense of it in relation to their experiences in some other disciplines like Buddhism or some non-duality type teaching.
Yeah. So, well, Douglas did a lot of work connecting it with other ways. He did a lot of work connecting it with science and showing how it makes sense in terms of our scientific view of the world. And there's lots around. For people to read, lots for free on the website, in the films on YouTube and so on, lots in the books and so on. So a huge amount of work has been done in that sense of linking it and making sense of it. Lots of room for people to contribute to that, of course.
And as you teach this and over the years, you're obviously living it, is it your experience, Richard, that the quality of the experience has become richer or deeper as you sit in it?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I'll just say one more thing about that last point about linking it to other ways.
Yeah.
It's quite common. Just recently a friend said this, that he'd been reading spiritual texts for years and years of the different religions and feeling, you know, occasional moments of insight and then confusion and not really getting it. Did the pointing experiment, went back to all these texts, and they all made sense.
Oh, wow.
Or rather, as you might say, you read them to find out if they're right or not.
Right,
in other words, don't read to find out if you're right or not. you've got the experience, and then you read them to see if they've got it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You will, you know, probably describe it in a different way. But then in terms of ongoing effect, you see, this headless experience is always the same. So it doesn't get, in that basic sense, it doesn't improve or change or get better.
Yeah,
it's timeless.
Yeah.
But one's life that flows from this, the one's reaction to this, response to this, the way it affects your life, this all changes and deepens and deepens and deepens. And that's, you know, lots of people's experience is you live with this and wow, it profoundly affects your life and goes on. It just keeps going deeper and deeper. It's astonishing. It's creativity and inventiveness, really.
It's it's profoundly wonderful, really, and at the same time,
it?
It's so simple. It's,
I know.
That's, I think that definitely for someone like me, I would be big into thinking and probably over intellectualized, certainly over analyzed stuff, and that can get in the way big time. And certainly for a while, got in the way of this for me. So it really is about just relaxing into it and giving yourself permission to just see.
Yes, and I mean, it's brilliant you're doing this interview. I mean, for a start, we're enjoying it together, right?
Mm.
So that's brilliant. And then we've it's open to anyone who's listening to enjoy this with us. And the thing, you know, it's such a profound implications for our relationships, because obviously from the outside, we're face to face and we're separate and there's all that, you know, we're different. And we accept that. That's what we learn as we grow up. We reawaken to this, and you see that you're face to no face. You're empty for the other. Their face is your own, in a sense, you could say. They are within you. This is a wonderful, profoundly different, sometimes very challenging, I suppose, observation to live from, you know, as well as keeping the other in mind of being separate. So, gosh, built open for the other, including the other, including you now as well as me. Gosh, that is the foundation of love, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
One other question that's just popped into me is when you're in that space, in that silence, and sort of just being the
like now.
Yes, like now. Where's your? Would you have an? Would your sense of awareness be seated, say physically anywhere in your body, or is it just all over in that picture, or would it be maybe in the heart space, or does that even come
all into over that picture?
Yeah.
You see, I think when you come home, you say, well, you point back at your center and see what you are at center. Well, that means you notice you don't have a center. You can't pin down this faceless space to one location. It's everywhere. And in that basic sense, one is gloriously everywhere, and everything is within one. Now, from the social point of view, of course, I understand I'm over in this body, you know, and others are in those bodies. So from socially, I say, all right, well, I'm over here, and I suppose my heart is here, and my head is there, and, you know. So in that way, I understand the idea of centers, you know. Great, I had no idea of that as a baby. I've learned that. Now I take that idea of a center over here somewhere further and really look for myself and see, well, there's no center. You know, my thoughts. You said your thought, you know, new idea, question popped up out in you. You see, well, it kind of pops up out of nowhere, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah.
So provisionally, you know, we say, well, you had that thought, you know, in your mind, in your head, that was yours and these are mine. But privately, we understand that this thought just comes out of the great no mind, magically.
Exactly. It's funny. I was kind of wondering how the heck am I going to manage to fill 45, 50 minutes of an interview on this topic, knowing what the topic was. Yeah, but believe it or not, I'm looking at the clock. And it's 49 minutes and 35 seconds.
Yeah, I know. I mean, wonderful to share this. Yes.
Yeah, it really, really is.
It's delightful.
Is there anything, Richard, you wanna add or say before I wrap this up?
Yeah, just to listeners, you know, and to yourself, of course, included. You know, be in touch if you want. I benefit as much as you do. This is a shared two-way thing. This is sort of infectious. And go to the website, headless.org. Join us on a free Skype meeting if you want to drop in. You know, that information is on the website under workshops there. You know, explore is on the website and lots of films. You'll get linked to the YouTube channel. So lots of people around, lots of friends available if you want to hang out, you know. But you've got it. You've got it. So great to share it with the one and many.
I'll put up the website details on the radio station's website as well, promoting this particular interview for this week. So listen, in the meantime, Richard, don't go away. I want to have a word with you after this. So in the meantime, I want to just thank you for coming on board and sharing this fantastic, simple, profound message. And there's a hell of a lot of information and tools and resources on headless.org, so I highly recommend people checking that out.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
It's been absolutely a pleasure, and lovely to connect with you again, Richard.
Yes.
Okay.
Wonderful.
All right.
All right.
All the best.
I'll stay on the line.
Take care. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.